Welcome to the Savvy Shrink Podcast, brought to you by MHNRnetwork.com. I'm your host, Andrea Schneider. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, therapist, and life coach. I will be sharing helpful information for individuals dealing with varying mental health challenges, ranging from trauma and loss to recovering from toxic relationships in love, work, and family, specifically as relates to narcissistic abuse recovery. Other poignant topics will include maternal mental health and special needs parenting, among others. The podcast welcomes guests who share their expertise in trauma-informed and evidence-based interventions, including the latest in neuropsychology. My ebook, Soul Vampires: Reclaiming Your Lifeblood After Narcissistic Abuse, is available at BookBaby and other digital online booksellers. I'm a believer in a strengths-focused perspective for my clients, which harnesses the power of internal wisdom in crafting the inner alchemy of healing. Please grab a cup of coffee or tea, and welcome to the Savvy Shrink. Welcome. My guest today is Kim Saeed. Kim is an international healing teacher specializing in recovery and rebuilding after narcissistic abuse. She is the author of the Kindle bestsellers, How to Do No Contact Like a Boss, and 10 Essential Survivor Secrets to Liberate Yourself from Narcissistic Abuse. Kim is a credentialed educator with a background in psychology, research and development, and organizational development. Her writing has been featured on several leading websites. She has also been a guest expert on several radio shows, including Mental Health News Radio, The Overwhelmed Brain, and Codependency No More. In 2016, Kim founded the New Life Academy and Healing Collective, which is an online school dedicated to helping survivors of narcissistic abuse to restore and redesign their lives. Her work has been shared in nonprofit women's shelters and has been lauded by therapists and mental health experts. Her course, the Essential No Contact Bootcamp, has helped people from all over the world to detach from toxic relationships and begin healing from narcissistic abuse. You can find Kim's work and sign up for her newsletter at letmereach.com. Her new podcast radio show, part of the Mental Health News Radio Network, can be found at Heal, Grow, Evolve with Kim Saeed. Kim, welcome to the Savvy Shrink.
Thank you so much, Andrea. It's such an honor to be on your show today. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh my gosh, so honored to have you. You're an amazing gift to the narcissistic abuse recovery field and have helped so many survivors. And it's a true honor to have you on the show today. And we'd love to hear you tell us about your work with clients as a coach for survivors of narcissistic abuse.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't do a large amount of one-to-one coaching any longer. But the coaching process really depends on where a client is in their journey of detaching from narcissistic abuse. You know, some haven't gone no contact yet, others have. And then there are others who've been no contact for a while and need help with maintaining no contact and moving forward. So when someone signs up for coaching, we drill down to what their most pressing issues are, and then together come up with action plans for forming new habits. And then, you know, we experiment with different healing modalities. So basically, I guide them through the no contact process and forming new habits. And also, I serve as a kind of surrogate attachment figure as they detach from the narcissist in their life. Because as we now know, narcissistic abuse does cause attachment trauma. Typically, we already have an insecure attachment style, and so that's just made worse inside that relationship. So I kind of stand in as their surrogate attachment figure as they are going through the no contact process.
That's fantastic. I can imagine that is so helpful for survivors because it is such a difficult process of disentangling from the trauma bond and having someone who can be a secure anchor and do some reality testing that they're going to be okay, that there's hope for healing. And so you've worked so hard to develop some pretty incredible, amazing programs.
And if you could tell us a little bit more about your no contact bootcamp, that sounds really amazing.
I think so. Well, it's almost finalized right now. So what that means is I'm tweaking it a little bit and adding some more modules, and then I'm going to wrap it up and move on to my next online course. But basically, the no contact bootcamp was born because after coaching so many people on the same obstacles, I wanted to be able to reach more people and help, you know, more people around the world to detach from toxic relationships. Also, while we may have different sets of circumstances, the struggles are often the same. We go through the same biochemical and emotional addictions. And so I just wanted to come up with sort of a streamlined process that anyone could sign up for and go through and progress through in their own journey of healing.
That's wonderful. There's such a need for that. And I've certainly found that to be the case with my clients, especially in the initial stages, removing oneself from that toxic bond with a narcissistic or pathological partner or family member. And there's so many people that are in need of that guidance to really cut that connection. So this sounds like an incredible service for survivors. And why would you say no contact is so important for survivors that are trying to understand removing themselves from this trauma bond? Why is no contact so important?
Well, aside from being under the influence of a narcissistic individual, you're enduring constant trauma triggers and manipulation. But aside from that, part of recovery is a biochemical withdrawal. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that, you know, we all know about victim peptides or neuropeptides. We understand now that we become addicted to the biochemicals that our body and our brain secrete when we're being abused emotionally, physically, financially. Just to kind of drill down a little bit on that topic, when we're in that constant state of fight or flight, for example, we develop an addiction to adrenaline. And we also, let's say the narcissistic individual has given you the silent treatment and you think things are over and you're just really low and depressed, can barely even get out of bed. And then they might text you with a simple hi or some silly emoji. And then all of a sudden you're feeling euphoric.
Yeah.
And we get addicted to those biochemicals, dopamine and serotonin and those sorts of things. That little tiny text actually activates the same pleasure centers in our brains as any other addiction to alcohol or drugs or shopping or gambling or whatever. Narcissistic abuse does at some point turn into not only a biochemical addiction, but a process addiction. And so recovery does involve getting through that withdrawal, and that's impossible to do if you're still in the toxic environment.
Right on. It's like going through withdrawal from a bad drug, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, I understand that some people aren't able to leave right away. And I was in that demographic at one point. I wasn't able to leave right away. It took me several months to be able to build up the financial resources to be able to leave. But it is important. It has to be done sooner or later.
Absolutely. I agree with you. And I certainly emphasize that with my clients. And I think it's fantastic you have a dedicated program that specifically addresses that, in addition to other services you provide that are unique and specific to survivors of this insidious form of psychological abuse. And there's so few people that are really trained in helping survivors. So what you're doing for survivors is so incredibly helpful and instrumental in their healing process. Yeah. It's the truth.
Well, in the boot camp, just to kind of talk about what some of the topics that are covered in there, helps with healing because it covers things like attachment styles, the coping schemas that we form. There's also a module on creating the no contact schedule because, again, no contact is important, but simply leaving the relationship is not what's going to heal you. There are several different elements of recovery that must happen. And part of that does include forming new habits. It's almost like you have to form a new addiction of sorts. It could be something simple like I became addicted, so to speak, to guided meditations. It was something very simple I could do while I was lying in bed, barely able to move. And they help because they help overwrite that negative narrative that we have in our minds, and they help overwrite limiting beliefs. And so you're just lying there and the meditation does all the work for you.
Yes. That's fantastic. So it's a lot of cognitive restructuring and looking at the thought process, looking at worth and worthiness is so important.
It is.
Yeah.
And to toot my own horn here, there is a private forum inside the boot camp that's, in my opinion, one of the best out there. We see these recovery forums out on Facebook all over the place. And a lot of them actually keep you stuck in trauma and drama because you're re-traumatizing yourself by reading the hundreds and hundreds of stories of abuse and betrayal.
Right.
The private group for the boot camp, first of all, you have to form healthy connections. And I've even seen people in my boot camp group who have formed friendships outside of the group.
That's fantastic.
You know, I saw a selfie recently of two students who had hooked up because they were close by and have started, you know, have formed a friendship. So it's a really healthy way of getting true support as you, you know, progress further into the recovery.
That is such a gift because I think you're absolutely right. There's so many forums online, and to a survivor that's reeling in the aftermath with the effects of cognitive dissonance from gaslighting, silent treatment, etc., they really need a safe anchor, a safe community to help them to feel empowered to move forward. And some of these forums, I've been told by some of my clients, are actually really disempowering and victim shaming and blaming. So to hear that there are some forums and safe online support groups, for example, the one that you offer, is really fantastic, because then survivors know that there's a safe place to go, and it's moderated and facilitated by a very qualified life coach who knows her stuff and is going to encourage safety. So that's fantastic that you offer that service. And it's wonderful because a lot of people are looking for that and they want to know the best forum to receive that kind of support. And so,
yeah,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, part of the boot camp early on is a challenge, you know, go in there, go on Facebook and actually unjoin most of those groups. Because again, what you feed your brain on a daily basis is where your thought patterns are going to either stay or form new ways of thinking. So when you're constantly going online, you know, these recovery forums claim to help you recover, but they're still posting all these very traumatizing posts, very psychologically harmful visual posters and pictures. And so they don't really help. They more harm than good.
I could see how that could be the case, and it could be re-triggering for the trauma, the emotional trauma. And actually, for some survivors, if there's a parallel in someone else's story, they may actually be tempted to re-engage in contact with their abuser, or they could be tempted to kind of fall back into those kinds of patterns. And I've also heard of circumstances where there's some re-traumatizing going on if there's some individuals who haven't kind of worked on their approach to offering advice, and it can feel more victim shaming and blaming. So I think it's sort of like a buyer beware kind of a deal. And fortunately, there are people like you who offer a safe place to land online. And that's such a gift, because being that people are spread out all over the world, they really need some sort of connection with a safe community. And in this day and age, that becomes online for so many people. So it's just wonderful that you offer that service. What other suggestions do you have for survivors in the aftermath of recovering from this kind of trauma in a romantic relationship, or even like a family relationship with a psychological abuser? Do you encourage your clients to do specific self-care strategies? I know you mentioned meditation is really important, and looking at the thought process. What are some other like self-care strategies that you suggest to your clients in this aftermath stage?
Well, the clients who sign up for one of my longer coaching packages actually are enrolled. They get a free enrollment in the boot camp. And inside the boot camp, there's a no contact schedule. And so I help people structure their time when they're home by themselves to come up with some new ways of just dealing with their day-to-day lives. And with that schedule, I include different activities that involve the different senses, because we all have different personalities and emotional intelligences. So I do include activities that people can choose from to fill up their no contact calendar. And for me personally, that include going out in nature, just getting lots of rest. Self-care is absolutely critical when healing from emotional trauma. And self-care includes not only the self-work that we have to do to heal, but just ways to allow the body and mind to rest. I've noticed that a lot of times people will keep themselves busy, which is often a subconscious way to avoid facing our inner wounding.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important to start some new habits and take those baby steps to start that journey of healing. But it's also important to keep in mind not to take on too many things, because some people in their eagerness to enter that magical land of being healed go out and join a bunch of groups and sign up for a few different therapists, join the gym, buy a bunch of books. That's just too much.
Absolutely.
So,
it's all about pacing, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's choosing a few different things that you can incorporate practically into your new schedule so that you don't just freeze and get overwhelmed and revert back to old habits that are usually the self-sabotaging kind.
That's like, great advice.
Yes. So take it slow, do things that allow you to rest, but also just stay away from those old habits like, you know, checking out Facebook or unblocking someone or maybe overeating or over drinking. So just take things slow and be gentle on yourself.
I think that's excellent advice. I really think that having that kind of tangible, concrete suggestions for self-care really helps survivors to know that they can easily implement some strategies that might rewire actually some of their brain chemistry. Because if they've been in the force field of toxic psychological abuse for some time, it's almost like their bodies have acclimated to that fight or flight mode. And to be able to access the relaxation response through the suggestions that you're mentioning, such as meditation, rest, hiking, those types of wonderful relaxation strategies that really evidence backs up as being incredibly wonderful for our brain health and our physiological health, that will really go a long ways in not only accessing the relaxation response, but also healing in terms of trauma, which our bodies hold on to so very much. So I think your suggestions are spot on and fantastic.
Thank you.
Yeah. And with that, what kind of suggestions would you have for clients who are re-entering the dating world after they've left a narcissist or a toxic relationship? So many people are a little trepidatious and concerned and worried that they might not have the discernment skills yet to determine if someone has some red flags potentially. So I'm curious to know, and I would imagine our listeners are also curious to know what you might suggest to look out for to prevent another toxic relationship from being repeated in a dating relationship. And what kind of red flags and suggestions do you have about pacing, online dating, etc.? What are your thoughts about that?
I, just from my own personal experiences and having worked with clients for several years now, I would never recommend going right back out into the dating field. You know, if you haven't done any self-work, I'd say don't even think of dating yet, because we have to heal our wounded inner identity, heal our beliefs, process the trauma out of our psyches, our bodies, and establish healthy beliefs. And if you haven't really done the work to do any of that, you're just going to go out and attract the same kind of person. But for people who have been doing some self-work, and let's say they've been out of the relationship, I usually say wait at least 6 to 8 months, and that's with doing daily self-work.
Mm-hmm. That's appropriate.
Mm-hmm. You know, just keep in mind that healthy love doesn't happen overnight. It doesn't even happen in a few weeks or even a few months. So that's why pacing is extremely important. While it feels good in the moment to get caught up in love bombing or an instant relationship, it only comes back to bite us in the butt later.
That's so true.
But for people who are afraid to start dating again, the thing is, you know, and I see these comments on the forums and chat rooms all the time, well, I don't think I can ever trust another person. I'm just going to stay single. And it doesn't have to be that way. As long as we have come up with our own list of personal boundaries and deal breakers, we never have to worry about another person. What I mean by that is personal boundaries might be something like, if you're a vegetarian, you certainly don't want to go out with a meat eater. Or let's say you're dating someone and they go out a lot with their friends, you might compromise, okay, well, let's have time together 3 or 4 nights a week, and the other nights you can go out with your friends. Those are personal boundaries. They're a little bit flexible, but they still need to be something that you're comfortable with. Now, deal breakers, on the other hand, are things that happen. They might happen the one time, but anything after that, you need to be willing to walk away and mean it. So lying, infidelity, for me, watching porn, those sorts of things would be deal breakers for me. If I were dating someone and I found out they'd lied to me, for example, the first time it could be a misunderstanding, or maybe it's something that had not been discussed up to that point. But after that, if it happens again, especially if it happens in secret and you find out later, you need to be willing to walk away.
Good point.
And a lot of times we think, oh yeah, but I got to work on this relationship. We have such a connection. I don't agree with that. I think regardless of the connection it feels like you have with another person, if they've broken your deal breaker, the last thing you want to do is keep giving them chances, because that's just going to end up in the same kind of situation as what we're trying to heal from.
Yeah, that's excellent advice. And I think a lot of people just want to give a new dating partner the benefit of the doubt. But then, like you said, if the dating partner is hitting that list of deal breakers and already sort of misbehaving at the very beginning, those clearly are red flags that people need to look out for. And that may include issues of integrity, honesty, and may involve their habits. Are they heavy drinkers? Are they drug users? Or do they have other addictions that are an issue? I mean, addictions are very problematic and certainly don't make people available emotionally to other folks. But I think too, a lot of my clients also talk about pacing, and they recall the intoxicating feeling of the love bombing, like you mentioned as well, and how that's a high like no other. And it's almost like the narcissist has ruined it for them, so that when they date healthy people, they're looking for that hit of intensity. And in some circumstances, in many circumstances, they're not going to find that hit of intensity, because with a narcissist, it's all false and it's all a masquerade of intensity. And so, you know, when survivors are embarking on the dating world again, they are looking for chemistry and they want that connection. But I think there's a red flag that people need to look at the pacing and the intensity at the very get-go. And if it's someone's coming on way too strong and promising the moon and the stars, that's truly a red flag, don't you think?
I do. I absolutely do. You know, and I'm glad we're talking about this, because, you know, I've written a few articles about love addiction. And honestly, learning about love addiction was one of my final hurdles. You know, I was still having very unrealistic beliefs about what true love really looks like. And I got a comment on one of my blog articles. Well, this is victim shaming. You know, if someone is a love addict, that implies that they're a victim. And, you know, that's not really true at all. Mm-hmm. And I believe that narcissistic abuse turns us into love addicts, even if we weren't before. And so what that means is we develop these very unrealistic beliefs and preferences for, you know, so-called true love. Mm-hmm. Which includes that really intense chemistry that you just talked about. Oh, we've got to be texting each other 50, 100 times a day. We got to be together every single moment, you know, and it's that fast forward progression and the moonlight walks and the dinners and the vacations. Those things are good, but right. if they're happening very quickly, we do become addicted to that, to the fantasy of true love. And right. so that's what we're looking for after we exit the relationship. So love addiction is a very real part of overcoming narcissistic abuse if it's a romantic relationship.
Good point. Very good point. And where would people find your articles about this type of love addiction and, you know, looking at discernment and what is a healthy relationship versus a toxic relationship? Do you have a specific blog where those articles are located so that people can read? You're a prolific writer, an outstanding writer, and I think so helpful to so many people.
Well, if people are interested in the things we just talked about, they would mm-hmm. just go to my site, letmereach.com, okay. and in the search bar, they could type in, I think the article with the personal boundaries and deal breakers is the only two things you need to avoid ever attracting another narcissist, mm-hmm. or they can just search for love addiction or love addict.
Okay. I think that's so helpful because really I see so many people that are wanting to have hope that they can have a healthy relationship in the aftermath of being in a relationship with someone who is a psychological abuser, and to be able to have some tools to look for the authenticity, the integrity, empathy, all those high emotional IQ type qualities that we're looking for in a healthy person that is very well boundaried and has good self-worth. And I know we've already kind of talked a little bit about this, but doing that work on oneself as a survivor is essential, like you said, before even looking for a significant other that might have those qualities as well. So I think this information is so incredibly helpful because most people who are human beings, you know, are social creatures and ideally and optimally would like to share their life with somebody. It's not essential for happiness, but I think most humans prefer to share their life with others. And so if we have some tools to look at for what are some deal breakers, what are the red flags, I think that's very helpful. And pacing is like if it's a slow build and you're really kind of mutually vetting each other with very slow vulnerability and slow disclosure versus a massive love bombing, I think it's so helpful for survivors to have that terminology and that understanding. And it's good that they know where to go to read about that too. So that's incredibly helpful.
Right. So, and, yeah. you know, one thing I'd like to add just to revisit that topic for a moment is sure. let's say you have been doing the self-work and you're in a new relationship after 6 to 8 months. I always say do not get engaged or move in together for at least a year. That allows you time to see how they are going to act and respond during holidays, birthdays, special events, you know, how they're going to react and respond when they meet your family. You're going to see how they handle different upsets in the relationship. And you get to go through the four seasons or however many seasons you have where you right. live. So I always say do not get engaged or move in before mm-hmm. a year.
I think that's great advice. And it certainly gives the survivor the opportunity to really vet their significant other and examine them to look for those qualities of integrity, of the ability to be accountable if they've made a mistake and then be able to compromise, to be able to have empathy, to be able to do the work of true love, which is a more mature state of being than when you're in the throes of infatuation and when it becomes...
Absolutely.
Yeah, when it's annoying that the other person left the toothpaste cap off or the toilet seat up or down, how does that person deal with the adversity? How do they deal with conflict resolution? And if there's a lot of rigidity, if there's a lot of projection, blame shifting, that's a real scary red flag. So, you know, I think looking for compromise and great skill at conflict resolution is an important thing to determine in a potential partner, dating partner. But the only way a survivor is really going to know that is through time. And so many people want to rush to reconnect with a love attachment because maybe they haven't done the work of healing or they feel incomplete. So again, that goes back to doing work for the survivor. The survivor needs to do their own work before they really are invested in putting the effort and energy into seeking love outside of loving themselves first. So
right. Absolutely. That's yeah. That's perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect advice.
It's challenging. It is. And I know that we work with clients who present with a lot of concerns and issues. We talk a lot about trauma, complex PTSD, PTSD, depression, anxiety. And these are very real clinical issues that clients definitely are impacted by being in the force field of narcissistic and psychologically abusive individuals. And so how do you address that as a life coach in terms of addressing those concerns and maybe referring to clinicians who also have this specialty? And also, how can clinicians and life coaches work together to help clients heal?
Well, this is a little tricky because I have had a large number of people sign up for coaching who've already tried the traditional route with therapists and counselors, and it didn't seem to help them move forward. And I think this is due to there being such a lack of properly trained professionals in the area of narcissistic abuse recovery.
Right.
But having said that, there are great ones out there, such as yourself, as you know, because I referred some people your way.
Well, thank you.
It's really important that the psychological community in general learns more about the dynamics of narcissistic abuse and what narcissistic abuse syndrome really looks like, even though that's not yet a condition that's in the DSM. The modern progression is kind of away from talk therapy and more toward subconscious healing and other methods such as cognitive behavioral therapy or EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization.
Yes.
And then those two things are very helpful for healing from, as you said, CPTSD or PTSD.
Right, right. And I can totally see life coaches and therapists working together to help clients. And being that you as a life coach are also a survivor, I think that makes it very powerful because you are lending hope to clients that they can have a better life, that they can move from surviving to thriving. And you practice what you preach and you're open about that. And so I think that counts so much for healing, is that there's a success story and that is you. And it hasn't been easy, but you've written about it prolifically and you share very candidly your journey. And I think that lends so much hope for your clients. Plus, you definitely psychologically understand what it feels like. You've been through the fire and you've lived to tell the tale. You're on the other side, thankfully, but it is something where you know it on a cellular level. And so it makes sense that you would write about it and share your wisdom. And you have a unique ability to help others because of that. And plus, you also understand the delicate nuances of the psychological aspects of trauma, and your clients are in outstanding hands. And it's wonderful that they can get a lot of work with self-worth and no contact and just fantastic information about how do you do dating after you've been with a narcissist, et cetera. You know, all of that stuff is so important. And then I think for those that have the complex PTSD, which is many, many people, whether they've grown up in a family where there's narcissistic abuse or maybe in the work world, they've had a horrible boss for a number of years or in a romantic relationship, certainly some individuals manifest symptoms of CPTSD or complex PTSD. And you're right, it's not in the DSM like it needs to be, and also narcissistic victim syndrome, hoping that that will be more recognized in the psychological community. And I think it does need to be addressed. I think the clinical community really needs more training in graduate school. And certainly I was not trained in this in graduate school. We maybe had a cursory overview of personality disorders, but I really think education should start in elementary school, talking about healthy relationships and toxic relationships. And that could sort of piggyback on the anti-bullying campaigns that we're seeing in a lot of public schools, at least out here in
right.
California. But that's a great sort of social skill to teach children from a very young age, and teaching about emotional IQ and what is empathy and what is compromise, and carrying that through middle school to high school when people start dating and actually experiencing some types of folks that might may be very toxic. So I think it goes back to not only educating communities, but most definitely therapists and life coaches. And maybe that's something that you can do. Are you thinking about being a trainer, Kim, or are you looking to do that?
Well, I would love, absolutely love to do that. Without, you know, sharing too many details, I am working with a colleague right now who wants to try to, and she's working on her PhD and wants to try to get the news out about narcissistic abuse syndrome or narcissistic victim syndrome. So, you know, I think that some things are on the horizon, but, you know, we've got such a, I don't know, a concrete sort of method, and it really needs to start in the psychological community with training. It also needs to start with one of the things I'm passionate about is if you have a narcissistic partner, spouse, who is a parent to your children, it's extremely important to get out of that toxic environment if you can or as soon as you can. And I know there's those fears. There are cases of parental alienation that are very real.
Absolutely.
But when your children are young, that's, and they're going through their formative years. I know that some people are born with no empathy, but I think that the large portion of people who turn into narcissists became that way because of their early childhood. So,
absolutely. I agree with you. I think
it was so important to get them out of there.
For sure. I think that's such an important message, Kim, because truly what children are exposed to definitely impacts the neurological hardwiring of who they are. And I think absolutely studies back that up, that when exposed to narcissistic abuse, it's obviously not good for the children. And they either learn how to be narcissistic themselves, or they learn how to survive a horrific home environment and perhaps develop some high emotional IQ empathy type traits, but it also sets them up to have the blueprint for being very familiar with narcissism and then potentially connecting up with narcissists in the future. So it's great advice to, you know, remind people that if there are children involved, that it's very essential to try to have that leave-taking plan ASAP. And so many people also too wonder, well, if I just stay with my narcissist a little bit longer, can't he or she change? And I get that question
a lot. I've never seen it happen.
Yeah.
I've been doing it several years now, and I've done tons and tons of research. I've looked, I was one of those people, can he change?
Yeah.
Maybe if I just do this or wait a little bit longer, he'll have that epiphany, or he'll finally recognize how much damage he's doing. And, you know, we all do that. We all ask that question. But I think at this point, you know, there are people that advocate that there's the chance for narcissists to change. And I actually wrote an article about that recently called The Biggest Misconception About Narcissism. I've never seen it happen.
Right.
I really don't think there's, you know, a chance for them to change. And if a person can change those kinds of behaviors, I think it's not narcissism to begin with.
Right. I totally agree with you. I think if someone is concretely in the NPD zone or crossed over into malignant narcissism, those characteristics are very much hardwired and fossilized and fused together in that individual's brain. And as sad as it is that that person has extreme limitations, they're already welded to who they are, and they're not really invested in wanting to change because they don't think they have a problem. So I agree with you. I've never seen anybody who's squarely in the NPD category or beyond, more extreme, really having the capacity to change. And it's hard to fathom that there's such rigidity and inflexibility in someone's psychological makeup, but it is the truth. And that's why people like you and I are out here trying to educate folks about what to look for. And, you know, people that really want to change and acknowledge that there's something about them that they want to evolve through and work on, have empathy. They have the capacity to compromise. They have integrity, authenticity. They have reciprocity, give and take in their relationships. And fortunately, I think there's a good portion of the world that has those qualities, but very clearly there's a lot of people who don't. And we see those people very overtly in positions of power, politicians, doctors, lawyers, therapists, you name it. Even people that claim to be altruistic sometimes are also covertly hiding behind that facade of of altruism. So it's not that everybody is horrific out there, but I think it goes back to, again, the need for education about healthy relationships. And I think it's fantastic that you have spent so much of your career really focusing on educating survivors and then moving into the place of educating providers and healing practitioners. So I'm just really happy to hear about your work. And I know our listeners are too. And wondering if you have any other words of wisdom that you'd like to share for our survivors as we kind of wrap up our interview today. Is there anything more that you'd like to add based on what we've discussed or something different related to narcissistic abuse recovery?
I think it's important that people just believe that recovery is possible.
Yes.
You know, that's really the first step, is believing it's possible. And when you look around and you see other people who have come out of the dark night of narcissistic abuse, people who have endured horrific betrayals and mistreatment. You know, I just had a coaching client, who was shot in the shoulder.
Oh,
gee. And she trying to, you know, empathize and sympathize with the guy. You know, you are important and you matter. You were not born by accident. We're all here for a reason. We all have talents that we can use to move our lives forward. One thing I'd like to bring up is maybe you're on disability or maybe you're financially dependent upon a narcissistic individual, but there are ways to come out of that. I did that myself. I was once so financially devastated that I had to sell my plasma to make ends meet. I often didn't even have money for a cup of coffee.
Wow.
So I just want people to realize that we don't have to stay stuck. We do have a choice. It may not always be the easiest one. There's always a way out.
Absolutely. I think that's such great advice. And it's a reminder for survivors to be helpful, because survivors have the capacity to change and heal. And it's wonderful that there are programs such as what you have to offer that can help others to heal. So, and with that, if you could share with our listeners where we can hear more about you and your programs and what you're involved in, if you could repeat where we can find your articles, your websites, and the things that you're involved in, I think our listeners would really appreciate that.
Well, sure. Thank you for giving me the chance to share those things.
Sure.
Well, my website is letmereach.com, and there you will find all the articles that you possibly can find on not only narcissistic abuse and the dynamics of that, but also lots of articles on healing and moving forward. If you look up at the top part of my website, you'll see a menu. You can find information on courses, information on coaching. I've also recently started a blog on psychcentral.com, because that's one of my efforts to branch out into the psychological community. And, you know, this colleague I mentioned a little while ago, she and I are working on something that I'm really excited to share, but not just yet.
Okay.
But
in a couple months or so,
we're going to have something really exciting.
Great.
To share with people.
Oh, that's so cool. And maybe we can have another podcast together and learn more about it when that time comes. That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, it's just really wonderful to share this time with you today, Kim. And thank you for sharing your wisdom. You have so many gifts to offer. And I think listeners have learned a lot. So I really appreciate your time. Thank you, Kim, for your time. And listeners, also thank you for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for showing up. And it was just a great honor to be on this show with you today, Andrea.
Thank you. Likewise, the feeling is mutual. I'm just so impressed with what you're doing, and you're a gift to the world. So thank you for helping the world to continue to revolve on its axis and helping people to heal. That's what it's all about, isn't it?
You're doing it too. So, you know, and that's why I refer people to you, because I know that you have that specialty in this area.
Thank you.
So thank you for what you're doing too.
I appreciate it. And I send folks to you as well all the time. And I know they really benefit from your programs and your writing. And this is how things can change and be better. So thank you for your work and really appreciate your time. And everybody have a good day.
Thank you again for listening to The Savvy Shrink. For more information about this podcast, go to thesavvyshrink.com or visit my website at AndreaSchneiderLCSW.com. This is your host, Andrea Schneider. Until next time.